From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. After almost a year of the coronavirus pandemic, racial injustice protests, and extreme political divisions, the nation is facing a mental health epidemic. And so today in The Exchange, we bring you the first in a three-part series called Taking a Toll. This hour, a broad overview of the varied mental health issues we're facing. Next week, we'll focus on children. And on March 3rd, we'll turn our attention to the elderly. We'll also talk about solutions and resources to help you during this difficult time. So, Exchange listeners, we really want to hear from you. How are you doing right now? What mix of emotions are you experiencing? What's helping you deal with them? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And our phone number is 800-892-6477. By the way, for anyone who needs it, the phone number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. That number and lots of other resources are on our website as well. Our guests for the hour are Paul Cody, a psychologist at the Behavioral Health Program at Equality Health Center in Concord. Paul, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Sonia Shropshire-Friel, a psychologist in private practice in Dover. And Sonia, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Ashley Silva, a licensed clinical social worker at Care Counseling Services in Manchester. And Ashley, good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, all of you, but Sonia, I'll start with you. Just what kinds of feelings are coming up for people these days? I'm guessing there's a lot.
Yes. Yes, there absolutely is a lot. One of the things I have noticed in general, as seems to correspond with some of the findings that a 2020 Stress in America survey also has found, which is stress is up, anxiety has increased. In a sense, we're viewing things from a COVID lens. And so anything that we may be struggling with is exacerbated right now. So increased anxiety, if you have OCD or obsessive compulsive disorder or struggle with that, there's a heightened sense of those symptoms impacting and interfering with life. If you have attention issues, you're struggling with even more attention issues right now. Just the adjustment in everyday life seems to be so much more challenging than it was, a year and a half ago.
Wow. Sonia, so people who already may have OCD or anxiety or PTSD or something, that gets worse given everything that we've been under. And are you seeing, Sonia, a lot of new people, you know, people who never felt like they needed mental health therapy before?
Yes. Yes. There have been conversations about how to, about I'm reaching out for help, but I'm not quite sure how to do this. I've never felt like I needed therapy before. This, you know, whatever they were struggling with wasn't an issue that impacted their lives until now. And the until now seems to be created, or what helps it along is, you know, some of what we're going through now, the sense of isolation, loneliness, things that we would normally do, we're not able to do. You know, brains need other brains to survive, and we're having to, you know, we're having to have those kinds of brain companionships on the screen, and that's hard.
Yeah. Well, and later on, we'll talk about connecting with others and how that's so important and how Zoom fatigue for many of us, myself included, is settling in. Ashley, how about you? What are you hearing from the people you work with again and again and again? What kinds of emotions are coming up for folks?
I think kind of just piggybacking on what Sonia said, just this new arrival of these symptoms that have never been experienced before. I have a lot of clients or consumers reaching out to me and saying, you know, I've never engaged in therapy before, but I'm really worried about this COVID situation. You know, when I was doing some research and, you know, Kaiser Family Foundation found that over 30% of adults in the US are now reporting symptoms of anxiety and depression in response to the pandemic. And 20% of these adults are reporting needing services, but not really getting them. And I think that a lot of the conversations I have when people call me is no one else is taking anyone right now. Do you have any openings? What's your wait list? And I think just, you know, there's such this immediate need for support that I don't think our system was ready for.
Wow. Yeah. And according to an article in New Hampshire Business Review that I just came across, Ashley, the executive director of the New Hampshire Psychological Association says between 95 and 100% of her members are not accepting new patients. So what do you do for those folks, Ashley?
I delved in and decided to start a private practice to open up more availability to be able to serve more people in Nashua. And I think that I just see that we are trying to be as flexible as we can to take in as many as we can. And I just find myself researching daily and reaching out and trying to find as many resources for these people as I can and giving them maybe like tiny things they can try to put into their lives now until they're able to find someone.
Right. We'll definitely talk about that later. You know, if you're waiting to find mental health help, what can you do kind of in the meantime? Paul, turning to you, what's changed for your clients? What kinds of emotions are people describing that's different from what they might have told you, you know, 2 years ago?
Well, people are feeling like everyone else, very constricted in their lives.
Right.
There's a disruption of what our daily routines were. Routines reassure us. There's lack of social connection. I mean, we can connect through Zoom some, but it's not like receiving or giving a hug. Just all these things that have disrupted their lives, and stress is cumulative, but also things like job loss, resulting economic insecurity, food insecurity. For younger people, disruption of the events that would have marked their lives, like going off to college or graduation ceremonies. So there's just this sort of overlay of stress from COVID that goes with whatever else they were already experiencing, including, I want to mention minority stress, people who are in groups that historically have been oppressed, LGBTQ people, people of color. Stress is cumulative, so it all adds up. And we know that there are health disparities before this pandemic, for those populations.
Well, and so let's talk about that a little bit, Paul. You know, you work with LGBTQ and non-binary clients. You know, what sort of particular mental health stressors do they face in this particular time?
Well, just getting support sometimes. I think of I want to talk not only about my clients, because it's a national trend. Back in the spring, when students were first sent home from colleges and universities, many of them have found a supportive community and connections there that helped them in expressing their identity. And some of them went home to families of origin that were highly supportive. Others went home to families that were still struggling or not accepting their students' identity. So that was a particular stress. Not for all of my clients, but some of them became more isolated in that way.
Oh, it's interesting. And Sonia, to you, Paul mentioned people of color. What are you hearing from your clients who are people of color, again, mm-hmm. after this, you know, tumultuous 12 months?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Paul raised a really salient point. One of the things that I have noticed jibes with some of what national findings have indicated. A 2020 study found that people of color are experiencing more stress and a perceived discrimination in their lives than they were in 2019. You know, it's up to 2 out of 5 people surveyed, 44%. I'm seeing that in, you know, my practice as well, and from people who reach out wanting to talk more about these stressors, because one issue is that COVID disproportionately affects, in terms of virus contraction, people of color, and issues surrounding being a part of a disenfranchised population. You know, there can be some real struggles, and have been some real struggles, about discrimination, the effects of systemic racism. You know, it can be as quote unquote simple as, you know, me recommending as part of treatment and ways to engage in self-care, to take a walk and, you know, enjoy nature or be outside in your neighborhood where you can breathe the fresh air and perhaps whatever sun might be here in New Hampshire right about now. But I hear reports where they're saying, I feel nervous about going out and walking. You know, there is a heightened sense of hypervisibility and not in a positive way. And so, you know, we've had to talk about what that might be like if you feel like you can go outside and take a walk and be in the fresh air. And so the simple things, you know, that we would take for granted really are becoming an issue and have become an issue for people of color.
Yeah. So you're telling your clients of color, Sonia, you know, one quick thing you can do is go out and take a walk in the sun and the fresh air. And they're coming back and saying, you know, that doesn't feel comfortable for me.
Right. Yes.
How hard is it, Sonia, for Black and Brown Americans to find a therapist of color who can relate to what they're going through?
Very, very difficult. And so as a result, you know, I do what I can. I think there may be several in the state of New Hampshire that I know of, including me. And it's really a challenge. And so when people of color are reaching out and saying, I would really like to work with you or someone, if you can't work with me, someone else of color, we have discussions about, you know, can you reach out and connect with someone who might be multiculturally sensitive, who believes in social justice and can acknowledge, you know, race in the room, and you feel like you're not needing to explain so much to, excuse me, this other, you know, this person, this therapist who doesn't share your skin color. And so sometimes my consultation calls are like a half hour.
Wow. Well, Ashley, to you, are there certain groups of people that you tend to be hearing from more frequently these days? Are there certain types of Granite Staters who are really having a hard time?
I think that my caseload right now is really heavy on the college age individuals. I think that, like Sonia had mentioned, this kind of disruption to how things normally go has been really hard for, you know, that population, because they thrive on that personal connection and this like college experience, right? And they're not getting that. They're locked in their dorm rooms, mostly on remote classes. And I think that, you know, I have a high caseload of that. I think also I have a high caseload of people who have, you know, family systems where there's substance or alcohol misuse or some type of issue that needs a support network, right? A physical group environment, and they don't have that right now. And so I think that it's just really, and obviously it's a theme through all of this conversation, this isolation piece and this inability to really access the full realm of services that are typically available.
Well, and again, we'll have lots of resources on our web post for today's show. It's nhpr.org/exchange. And I want to remind listeners that you can join us right now with an email or a phone call. Today's show is the first in a three-part series on mental health that we're calling Taking a Toll. This hour, it's a broad overview of the emotional strains that so many Americans are struggling with. And listeners, let's hear from you. How has the pandemic and all the other events of the past year affected your mental health, and what are you doing to try to address that? Email us at exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. And Ashley, to you, since you mentioned people who are struggling with addiction, Marilyn wrote into NHPR's coronavirus survey. Marilyn says, I am most concerned by the enduring disruption families are facing and have been grappling with for so long. Children are not learning, families are not coping, and no one really knows what will happen next. Marilyn says, there is rising mental illness as stress and loneliness drive people to their breaking point. Many of us are in recovery from addiction and or alcoholism, and the access to regular meetings is either remote or pushing the gatherings limit at in-person meetings. Marilyn, I'm glad you wrote in. And Ashley, what about that? What are you seeing in terms of people in recovery and their ability to follow through with these very important meetings and connections to stay in recovery?
You know, I think the individuals who have really strong support networks and natural supports already in place are able to navigate this a little bit better and to kind of try to find as much as they can on the virtual realm. And then on the other side of that, I think you have the individuals who are already so limited in their natural supports. And so they're really leaning on their therapeutic services to kind of keep them afloat and help them stay on the path. And I think that, you know, it's difficult. And I think that us as therapeutic providers, we're really trying to figure out how can we keep that boundary of keeping these people afloat, but also helping them be autonomous and self-leading. And so it's this kind of dichotomy that we're trying to address.
Well, and the assumption, right, Ashley, is that people have access to online resources. Some people don't have great internet access or no digital access at all.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that is the other point of it. You know, when the remote things got put into place and this require for virtual presence, and then you have lower socioeconomic individuals or rural individuals who don't have access to these things. And so it honestly was like we had to pause and say, okay, we don't have these things. How do we put these things into place? And I don't necessarily know that we have all these answers right now, but I think it really brings to light the need systemically to be paying attention to these things. Because I think long after the pandemic has passed, these are all things that we really still have to pay attention to.
Yeah, we've got a couple emails from people saying kind of what you said, long after this has passed, we're going to have to start looking at some of these fundamental issues. Thank you for writing, Marilyn. Let's go to the phones. Erica is calling from Manchester. Erica, welcome to The Exchange. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much. I was just talking about the problem with health insurance, with so many people that still have a problem getting health insurance, you know, and especially people that are in positions where maybe they're homeless, maybe they're addicts, maybe their families just don't have the ability to get them insurance. That's a segment of the population that needs it more than anybody. And I don't know how we are going to address that because they don't even have insurance. So them getting mental health is going to be that much harder.
Erica, I really appreciate the call. And boy, we have talked about this so much in the past. And you're right, Erica, more than ever, people need mental health services. Paul, what about that? People who don't have health insurance, people who may be very low income, as Erica says.
Well, we could talk for many sessions on yes. the national health insurance problem. What I will say is that I have in my caseload some people who are very low income or who are unemployed and who have been able to get Medicaid. And I accept Equality Health Center accepts Medicaid. And you know, and for people who don't have insurance, we have a sliding scale. So there are ways that we try to meet that need in what we do here.
Sonia, do you want to jump in on that as well?
Yes, and I would agree with Paul and Erica as well, that this is such a pervasive problem. And, you know, I'm guessing that each of us has worked with someone who, you know, is either underemployed, has become underemployed, or has lost, you know, their job and insurance benefits. And with that, I do try to work with individuals and not only do a sliding scale, but, you know, sometimes in our caseload, we have space for pro bono work. And so if you can see someone, and that's possible, right, in your caseload, that can also be helpful. But it really is a challenge. And so for individuals who are underemployed or have lost health insurance and are looking for someone, you know, checking out the biographies of different psychologists and therapists and mental health workers in the area who engage in sliding fee and have that on their websites or their profiles is a way to start that process of connecting with someone if you don't have insurance.
Well, and coming up after a short break, we will talk more about resources. So I'm glad you called, Erica. Resources for folks who think they need help. And I'm also going to ask my guests, even if you're having a hard time finding mental health resources, are there short-term strategies or advice that they recommend that you can do to make yourself feel a little bit better? So all that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
A few things have changed since NHPR first began as Granite State Public Radio back in 1981.
Welcome WEVO in Concord, New Hampshire to the NPR and All Things Considered family.
But through it all, local listener support has made this station possible. And for a limited time, we'll send you a classic canvas tote featuring the retro Granite State Public Radio logo when you become an NHPR sustainer at the discounted rate of $13 a month. But don't wait. Give now at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're kicking off a three-part series on mental health called Taking a Toll. In this first show, an overview of the emotional struggles of so many Americans right now. Next week, we'll focus in on children, and after that, the elderly. Listeners, how have the pandemic and all the other events of the past 12 months, extreme political division, racial injustice protests, how has all this affected your own mental health? And what's helping you address those feelings? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. We're talking with two psychologists, Sonia Shropshire-Friel and Paul Cody. Also with us, clinical social worker Ashley Silva. Again, our number is 800-892-6477. One more question about, you know, what all of you talked about before the break, how hard it can be to find a therapist. They're all booked up, but we also talked about, you know, places where people can go if they're low income, sliding scale, Medicaid, and so forth. Paul, just curious, on earlier shows, we have heard from therapists who say that they are able to see possibly more clients because everybody's connecting online and therapists are now getting reimbursed for telehealth visits. So I'm just wondering what you found on that end. Has that opened up a little bit more opportunity for you?
Not really, in terms of I have a finite number of hours that I can offer. It's made it accessible for people. I had never done teletherapy, and in a 2-week period last March, I pivoted to that. And so it's just a very different modality. It makes it easier for some clients who used to drive from far away, but it has its downsides. Some of my clients really don't like teletherapy, and I find there's a lot missing from the session, but it's a good substitute as we need it.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I'd like to get everybody's perspective on that, actually, before we go back to listeners. Ashley, how about you? Teletherapy and how it's working for you and your clients.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that's one of the biggest things for me, at least with the population that I work with. This idea of telehealth and the insurance companies finally acknowledging it has, I've gotten to be able to reach so many different people who didn't have transportation or the ability to get to the office or too much fear to get to the office. And I think it really shows, again, like I said, after this pandemic, like this is a way we're able to get to a larger amount of people, or I am at least, you know, this college population who are on campus but still need support and can't travel back and forth. I think that it definitely, you know, highlights the need for some new modern, you know, ways to be able to implement services. And like Paul said, there are communities or populations that, you know, may not necessarily get the most benefit. You know, I'm thinking my social anxiety people, my school anxiety people, right? This might enable some more of their isolative behavior. But I think in like the grand scheme of things, it's been such a help for us to be able to continue to do our work and to do it in a way that reaches the most amount of people as we can.
Oh, that's interesting. So for the younger people that you work with, Ashley, who maybe are more used to connecting that way, it's been working well.
Yes.
Sonia, how about you? I'd love to hear how you're using telehealth these days.
Yes, using telehealth so much more. And what that has allowed is for me to be able to connect with clients all over the state, you know, people who may have had a longer drive, as Paul was sharing, you know, now I'm able to connect with them in a way that isn't bound by distance. And so that's been helpful. Also, you know, lunch hour meetings have been helpful for people. You know, they're able to kind of whisk away to their car or someplace, you know, a little bit more private and talk. Some of the challenges, it really feels like when I'm meeting with someone in person, there feels like there's an energy in the room, and you're trying to get a sense of that energy online or on the screen. And that can be a real challenge. It almost makes you want to kind of take your face and move it even closer to the camera so you can get a sense of, you know, whether somebody is moving or whether there's a tear coming down. And so I've noticed that, you know, the nuances, the physical and facial, you know, cues that we might get, there's a bit more of a challenge with that, but still I've found it to be a really useful moment of therapy.
Well, and speaking of, you know, young people, college students, the struggles they have, Nat wrote to NHPR's coronavirus survey. He says, "I'm terrified it's never going to go back to normal. I'm worried I won't be able to go back to school in person and finish my degree. I'm worried my mental health will become so poor." Nat says, "We're all going to need intensive therapy once this is over." Nat, thanks for writing on our survey. And back to our callers. Suzanne's calling from Sugar Grove, Illinois. Suzanne, you're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Okay. Go ahead, Suzanne.
Okay. I just wanted to say that the way I deal with the pandemic, and I haven't been out much because I have an autoimmune disease, but I have tried to remain positive and count my blessings every day. And my daughter is in Houston with no water and no heat, and I'm in Sugar Grove with heat and water, so I'm very thankful for that.
Grateful for that, yeah.
Yeah. And then another thing that I've done, I think helping people is really good right now. And what I've done, I like to make cards, and I set up a thing with a Sugar Grove food pantry and distributed to people, about 900 cards to people. And we were able to raise over $5,000 and assisted 1,098 individuals. And then for groceries, we distributed more than 260 holiday meal boxes, is what the gal from the food pantry wrote me a letter and told me. So I just remain positive by trying to help other people. And that
well,
has
Suzanne,
helped me to get
yeah.
through this.
I am so glad you called, because two things that she said, all of you, do come up again and again and again as, you know, small ways that we can feel better. And one of them, Sonia, is gratitude. I can't tell you how many times I've seen the advice, keep a gratitude journal, no matter how bad your day was, you know, write down at the end of the day, three things that were good. Maybe it's as basic as she said, as, you know, heat and power. What do you think about that, Sonia, the importance of gratitude for things, no matter how small?
I think you and Suzanne raised such an important point. In the midst of what can feel like, you know, some of the more difficult times, we have a tendency to focus a bit more on the difficulties. But one of the things that are also co-occurring with those difficulties are some positives. Maybe it's as simple as, you know, you got a card in the mail. And as Suzanne was saying, you know, she's making cards available. It can really be important to highlight the positives that happen. And sometimes it feels like they're far and few in between. But the exercise that, you know, you were sharing, the three good things, you know, can not only help us cope, but also helps to begin to kind of rewire over time the brain, right? Where we're actually looking for those good things, even in the midst of crises.
Oh, that's interesting. So it isn't just, okay, at least I have heat and power. It's rewiring the brain, Sonia. So you start to search for those positive things. That's really interesting. What about, Paul, I think I'll turn to you on this. I have also read, you know, 100 times about the importance of volunteering. And, you know, many people may be thinking, yeah, I know it's good, but I'm emotionally exhausted as it is. But why is volunteering so important to, you know, help yourself feel a little bit better?
Well, I would broaden volunteering into just doing good for others.
And right.
Often with my clients who are depressed, I recommend that they think of small ways or larger ways to do good for others, because when we engage in that process, we're less focused on our internal state. We're thinking of someone else. And studies have shown that doing good for others benefits one's mood more than doing something for yourself. And so that is a way to refocus and feel better.
Yeah, that's interesting. I just got an email from a friend yesterday who sent it around to a large friend group saying, here's what the food bank needs, you know, get to it, folks. So I really appreciate you calling, Suzanne. Paul, did you want to jump back in?
I want to piggyback on something just about that.
Sure.
I'd also like to encourage people to limit some activities, what they call doom scrolling nowadays. Roxanne Cohen-Silver from UC Irvine did a study with 6,500 people and found that during this time of pandemic, heightened engagement with the media increases anxiety. And I think that there's a way that a lot of us have been, you know, checking the New Hampshire COVID rates or things like that. And I encourage my clients also to titrate or limit how much, you know, check the media, but don't do it compulsively because it increases your anxiety.
I'm so glad you said that. And Paul, correct me if I'm wrong. I think the World Health Organization said no more than 2 hours of news a day. You know, beyond that, it's too much.
I tell people to do even less than that, people who are highly anxious. Like, well, you can check once a day and find out everything big that happened.
Yeah. Well, and Ashley, to you, again, since you mentioned you work with young adults now, you know, older people may say, sure, 2 hours a day, I can do that. But younger people are constantly scrolling. I know I have two young adults in my own life. So what are you telling the people you work with about doom scrolling? I'm so glad you mentioned that, Paul. Go ahead, Ashley.
Yeah, you know, I think that as a society, we have kind of engaged in this connected disconnection, right? And so the way that we stay connected with each other is by spending most of our day on all of these social media platforms. But I also limit the time that we're spending on those. And I tell people, give yourself, you know, because we can't just pretend it doesn't exist. So give it its moment, take those 5-10 minutes to fill yourself in, and then make the mindful choice to kind of put it down and separate yourself from it. You know, and I also wanted to just quickly talk about, we were talking about like this idea of gratitude, or, you know, this idea of mindfulness, right? And so I think that, you know, I ask people to transition from focusing on this negative theme that's happening in the world and trying to shift towards this, like, you know, I do a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy, right? So how do our thoughts influence our behaviors and our actions? And so, like, trying to be more grounded and, you know, put some post-its up around your mirror, pick one thing that you're grateful for that day. And at the end of the week, look at all of those things that can help you realize that, yes, this bad thing is happening in the world, and my brain is now autopiloting to recognize the good as well. I think limiting access to the negative and the doom scrolling, I 100% am behind that. And I try to do that as well.
Wow. So a bunch of emails coming in from listeners. Douglas says, New Hampshire has a robust amount of well-trained peer support staff and services around the state. This includes a peer support agency in every county, peer-run crisis respite, and peer-run warm lines. These services are free and are offering telehealth through group meetings and one-to-one peer support. Douglas says, my peer support community is a massive part of my health and wellness. We need to talk about these services more. Douglas, I'm thrilled that you wrote in, and we will put more information about peer support and the network on our web post today. Again, it's nhpr.org/exchange. So Douglas, thank you so much. Here's an email from Anna that I really want to share with all of you and talk about it. Anna says, I'm having a really hard time functioning. I've had an extreme increase in anxiety and depression, and have tried different antidepressant medications over the past 6 months. The words that would describe how I am doing: despair, depression, anxiety, difficulty completing everyday tasks, to the point of feeling nearly catatonic. Anna says, mental health counseling helped a little, but not significantly. Unhealthy coping behaviors have increased, such as alcohol consumption. I still have frequent crying spells and difficulty parenting. Anna, I am 100% sure you're not alone in feeling these ways. Could you talk maybe to you first, Shauna, about women in particular, I have been reading a lot about the mental health aspects of this pandemic and all the other stuff we've seen in the past 12 months on women in particular. I'm just wondering what your perspective is on that.
Well, that's such a great point or a series of points that Anna raises and about the issues of, you know, women struggling. There can be this perception that that we need to do it all, you know, that we might be caregivers and we do that, and then we try and care for ourselves, and there feels like there isn't time left, or we can feel guilty about taking the time in order to, you know, engage in self-care or reach out to others in a way that benefits us. And so, you know, trying to take small moments, right? Looking at the global aspects of what we're going through, including when we have anxiety, because anxiety is about looking far, far, far into the future with moments that haven't even happened yet. Trying to find something that grounds you where in your immediate surrounding, you know, where you can actually take in, you know, we talk about the mindfulness exercise of, you know, three things you hear, three things you feel, you know, feel your feet on the floor. Sometimes it is as basic as remembering that you are in the world and that you're part of the world, and that this situation is these feelings and these emotions are normal responses to abnormal situations.
What does it mean, Sonia, that we have been in this for a year? You know, all of you have talked about sort of the way the brain is trained and the things the brain does when it's under stress. We've got that fight or flight response. What does it mean, Sonia, that we've been dealing with all this uncertainty and isolation for so long?
That's such a great question. One of the things that can happen when we have that fight, flight, or freeze response being a part of our day for so many days, we can experience significant releases of cortisol, the stress hormone that helps us, you know, with stress. But when there is an output that happens chronically, it can really be a difficult impact on your body. And so your heart rate will increase, your muscles tense. These kinds of daily situations can lead to high blood pressure and a stress on the heart, not to mention other, you know, somatic symptoms like headaches and, you know, gastrointestinal upset. You know, sometimes we feel like we're coming down with something. It can be the body's way of letting us know that something isn't normal, isn't in the everyday. And so, yes, over time, not only can we experience emotional and psychological fatigue, but our bodies let us know that, you know, we need to listen to it.
Wow. So physical health impacts from this constant stress that we're under. And Ashley, you've said even in normal times, our brain likes to write the story. How is that tendency to sort of write the story ahead of time affecting us right now, given that the story keeps changing every day?
Yeah, so by nature, I see with anxiety and depression, we have a lot of distorted thinking, or like what we call cognitive distortions. And so those could look like fortune telling, you know, I'm going to guess what's going to happen, catastrophizing, I'm going to think about the most worst thing that's going to happen. And so our brain, I imagine, like when I explain it, it's like your brain's on legs, right? And it's running away from you to this place that doesn't really exist. We have to kind of pull it back. And it's really hard, I think, in these moments when, unfortunately, we're being reinforced when we look at the TV, right? Because the TV is fortune telling and the TV is catastrophizing. And so I think that it's just a matter of having the ability to check your brain, to pull it back and to say, okay, wait, is this rational or is this irrational? And also right now, you know, if you look at like psychological trauma, which is basically after like living through a frightening or distressing event, like your brain starts to have trauma responses, right? And so we're having that, you know, disbelief, confusion, we're anxious, we're feeling withdrawn from others, we're feeling hopeless, right? And so I think normalizing some of that and realizing we're not alone, like, unfortunately, we may be not next to somebody, but this whole world as a whole is feeling the same thing. And so just as much as you can, trying to stop your brain from running away to that distorted thought and replacing it. And this isn't like a Susie Sunshine reframe, right? We're not going to go, oh, the world's the best place that it can be. But something as simple as, this will pass. Today is just today. This is not forever. Those little mantras to try to, you know, trick your brain or train your brain to try to get to that other part.
Yeah, sure feels like forever. But we'll set that aside, Ashley. You know, Paul, our emailer earlier, Douglas, said talk about peer support services, and that sounds great. And like I said, we'll put more information on our web post for today. But what else do you advise people, Paul, who maybe aren't sure if they need full-blown therapy, they just need to reach out, other sort of resources for folks who may not be as easily or as readily tapped into sort of traditional mental health therapy?
Well, there are a number of things in terms of anything that increases connectedness. I have some clients who regularly engage in online D&D groups, and their weekly D&D group is a source of support and laughter and recreation. I have other people who go on certain chat fora. So in this time, trying to find ways to connect is very important. And I just want to say what I, with my clients, jokingly call my grandmother's advice is, you know, all this stuff about eating healthy, watching your drinking habits, because we know that consumption of alcohol has increased like 2.5 times, regulating your sleep, exercising, meditating. I'm a big fan of the brief meditations posted by Tara Brach, that's B-R-A-C-H, on her website. She's a psychologist who's a meditation teacher. Journaling your feelings helps. So these are all ways that you can take care of yourself, and some of them need to involve connecting with others, especially through interests you might have.
So your grandmother's advice, eat right, get plenty of sleep,
don't
go for
a
walk, don't drink too much. And I have heard that, you know, that's definitely become an issue that some in the state are worried about, people using alcohol, as Anna, our emailer, wrote. We need to take a very short break. When we come back, more of your emails, more conversation with our guests. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org, and our phone number is 800-892-6477.
NHPR is live.
Historic event, and she joins us on the phone now for some reaction. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Rick.
Local.
Dartmouth College and the University of New Hampshire are planning in-person graduation ceremonies this year.
And listener-supported. And right now, when you support your source for community connection and quality journalism, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar by a generous group of NHPR donors. Double your impact right now. Give at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the first in a three-part series on mental health that we're calling Taking a Toll. Let's hear from you. How would you describe the way this past year has affected your mental health? And has that changed over the past 12 months? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or call 800-892-6477. We have three mental health professionals with us. They are Paul Cody, Sonia Shropshire-Friel, and Ashley Silva. One more time, that number, 800-892-6477. Also, listeners, we have been talking a lot about resources and advice. If you're having a hard time emotionally, those are on our web post for today's show. It's nhpr.org/exchange. All of you, I want to share an email from Sarah and ask you what you think, because it raises a big point. Sarah says, my spouse and I have white-collar jobs that we've been able to do from home. We have not experienced any loss of income. We have not lost any loved ones to COVID. And I feel so guilty that so many have been sick or lost income, family, or friends. There are days when I should be working, and I find myself staring into space, or worse, doom-scrolling the news or social media. Sarah says, there is a bruise on my spirit, and I know so many people had a much worse year Guilt is both the bruise and the boxing glove I use to beat myself up. Sarah says it will take a long time to rewrite these internal narratives of sadness, shame, and guilt. Sarah, thank you for writing. And Ashley, I think to you first, what about this? The idea that, you know, she's got it pretty good and she feels bad for feeling bad.
Yeah, I think it's almost like this idea of like survivor's guilt, right? Like we're making our way out of this when others aren't. You know, my biggest thing to consumers is that no one person's, you know, depression or sadness is greater than another's. You may feel varying levels of it, but you need to validate that for yourself. Because yes, maybe things haven't changed exponentially for you, but also, you know, you are still feeling the emotional toll of everything around you. And I think that, you know, it's empathy, right? We're having empathy for these other people. And so I think just if you are in a place where you're not as affected, I think just taking a deep breath and saying, that's okay. And there are people who are struggling. And those two things are going to have to exist together right now. But what you can do is reach out to the people that you can. Ask a friend how they're doing. You know, just, you know, use your positive situation to be able to use that mental health and that healthy, stable place to reach out to somebody else and do what you can there.
Yeah, I'd like to ask everybody on this. Sonia, go ahead. What do you think?
What I would say to Sarah is what I would say to other people who may not have, you know, some of the same kind of hierarchy of needs issues that others might be, you know, where they, you know, do have some resources. I would say that this is hard. This is hard for all of us in different ways. And, you know, she may have those resources and she's still struggling. And so, you know, sometimes when we engage in comparison and contrasting, we have a tendency to minimize our own experiences and saying, well, it's not that bad. And so as a result, we start to maybe suppress, you know, some of the emotional and psychological experiences that we're having ourselves. And so it's real, and it's real for everyone, you know, in perhaps in different ways. Something else I would suggest anyone do if they're feeling like, you know, what do I do? I'm not exactly sure what to do with these feelings. I feel for other people. I feel for myself. You know, what can I do? Loving kindness, meditation exercises can be helpful where you place a hand over your heart, think of people who might be struggling or think of a family member or think of yourself and say, perhaps, you know, may this person be healthy or may these people be healthy. You know, may they be safe. May they be happy. It may not be that they are, but there is this enduring hope that I think we can also come away with from this, you know, these series of crises. And I think that loving kindness and sending it out into our world and wishing it for other people is also something on a rather basic level that we can do.
Paul, what do you think? Sarah feeling bad for doing relatively well?
Well, that sort of guilt is understandable when we see all the impact on other people. But I want to just reinforce what's been said already, that Sarah, you and everyone else has had their life disrupted. And we're not in the afterword yet. This is not like a trauma happened to our society and it's over. And you're dealing with the uncertainty of where things will go in your life as it moves forward. So again, it's being kind with yourself, like Sonia was saying, and understanding the impact this has had on you, on your family, and how it's changed your lives. And then again, doing what you can to feel like you're contributing to the common weal, whether it's through loving kindness meditation, whether it's donating to your local food bank or any other efforts, making cookies for your neighbor, all these ways that we can connect with others and feel like we are having some impact on their lives.
Here's an email from Rob who says, as a first responder, the stress has been overwhelming, from the ridiculous politicization of masks to the slow rollout of the vaccines. It feels like every time we take a step in the right direction, we are forced to take two steps back. When someone calls for help, we show up. Anyone who needs help will have it, but the over-entitled and selfish people who willingly put others at risk make me think if this line of work is even worth it anymore. Wow, Rob, thank you for writing. And Paul, I think I'll turn to you. You know, we hear this mantra all the time, we're in it together, we're in it together, but people do have different ways of approaching this pandemic. Some take it more seriously than others. And Rob is incredibly frustrated. What do you think? Dealing with that sort of anger, really?
Well, first of all, I have to say, I understand some of Rob's anger personally. When I go about in public and I see people who are not following the governor's requirements of wearing masks when they go in certain stores or other such behavior, it angers me because they're not only putting themselves at risk, they're putting all the rest of us at risk. And then how we manage that anger so that it doesn't become something toxic inside us that we carry around and it's only corroding us. It's not doing anything to the people we were angry at. We need to handle it well ourselves. It's such a challenging time. And in terms of points of view, and I don't want to get into a lot of details, but conspiracy theories have been around ever since there have been disasters. And I'll say that denial is one of the most primitive defenses. It's one of the first ways that people try to guard against uncomfortable realities. And so that just adds to this. People who are saying all these falsehoods about the pandemic, they're in their own defense mechanism, but it's not helpful to the common weal.
You know, all of you, last question, and it's a personal one. Paul, I'll go to you first again. What's helping you get through mentally at this time or emotionally, Paul? Your grandma's recommendations, for example, eating right and getting fresh air and so forth. What's helping you, Paul?
I want to say, just to normalize that, as a therapist, I get challenged sometimes just in my personal life by this. So,
right, you're overwhelmed.
Being connected to family. We had an 8-hour open Zoom meeting Christmas Day. People came and went. I showed people what I baked through the camera. I've been a spiritual person for a long time, and practicing my spirituality really helps me a great deal. And finding meaning in the work I do, that's helpful for me and perhaps for people like Rob, who's a first responder.
Wow, an 8-hour open Zoom. I had not thought of that. That's a little less pressure, Paul. I like that.
I have a family member who's an IT professional and can host up to 100 people for 24 hours. So we just opened it up. We kept it open. People came and went. It was wonderful.
Yeah, a little less pressure too, to sort of show up and, you know, be really focused for 20 minutes or whatever. Sonia, how about you? What are you doing to sort of keep yourself going?
The things that Paul was just sharing, those are incredibly important, at least for me personally. You know, the FaceTime has become my best friend, other than, my spouse and mom and dad and brother and my nephews and niece and sister-in-law. I mean, there's social support there. That's really important. And as Paul was saying, you know, spirituality as well, recognizing that this is temporary, because all things essentially are temporary, and it's what we do with the time that we have is helpful for me to remember. On another level that is more me oriented, I do puzzles and I color.
Those beautiful adult coloring books that started coming out, 5-10 years ago, Sonia? Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, my dad has recently gotten into those, and his apartment now looks sort of like an art museum because he's hanging these up all over the apartment, and they're gorgeous. Ashley, how about you? What are you doing to sort of keep yourself mentally well?
You know, as a therapist and a mom and all of that, I think that for a long time, you know, I touted this idea of self-care, right, to other people. And I've decided and actively been working on turning that back to myself. And I think, you know, I make things for my family. I work from home Mondays and Tuesdays. And so what I do is between sessions, I just go and hug and kiss my kids. And I just kind of try to focus on the fact that, yes, we've been stuck in this house for over a year and we've had this ability to be around each other more. And so I think just taking time for myself and allowing myself to take a break from being a mom and being a therapist and just be me and do the things that I like for at least, you know, 20 minutes a day if I can.
Wow. Well, Ashley, thank you for being here very much.
Thank you for having me.
That's Ashley Silva, a licensed clinical social worker at Care Counseling Services in Manchester. And as she told us, she's opening up her own practice in April so that she can take more clients. And we have information about that on our website today. Sonia, it was really great to talk to you too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That's Sonia Shropshire-Friel. She's a psychologist in private practice in Dover. And Paul, thank you again. It was really nice to talk to you today.
Well, thank you for including me.
That's Paul Cody. He's a psychologist at the Behavioral Health Program at Equality Health Center in Concord. Again, listeners, all the resources and information that our guests mentioned today, as well as the organizations that they work for, will be on that web post for today. So definitely check it out if you need help. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Once again, nhpr.org/exchange. Also, whenever we talk about mental health, we like to give out the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It's there for anyone who needs it. That number is 800-273-8255. Our mental health series, Taking a Toll, is produced by Jane Vaughn. And next week in the series, we'll talk about the mental health impacts of this past year on children. So in advance of the show, listeners, send us your stories and your questions about that. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.